Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, January 2nd. Today we talk about what to do about the illegal aerial fireworks following the four deaths over the New Year's Eve celebrations. We take a closer look at Hawaii's favorite cars, and if you guessed Toyota and Honda, well, you got it right. And the Narcissus Festival celebrates 75 years. We learn about how the Chinese community plans to celebrate the big milestone. A new documentary about the man behind the international marketplace, his other exploits, might surprise you. And we take a look at 40 years of turtle strandings, why we've seen record numbers in recent years. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Investigators are still trying to understand what led up to the fatal fireworks explosion in the Aliumanu area that left three women dead and some two dozen others injured. At a news conference yesterday, both the mayor and the governor pledged to do more to deter the sale of illegal aerials. Mayor Rick Blangiardi called the situation a systemic problem. Governor Josh Green said rather than an all-out ban, he would first look at increasing penalties for possession of illegal aerials. This morning, we talked to Representative Della Albulati, head of the House Public Safety Committee, about what more lawmakers can do to stop the flow of illegal fireworks.
So this is a serious matter. I think that the governor and the mayor have made a good point that enough is enough. And I think there's going to be a concerted effort to look at what the Illegal Fireworks Task Force is doing, if they can escalate their efforts to stop the flow of illegal fireworks into the community and what kind of resources they're going to need. I know that there are calls for more stringent rules. So, Catherine, this is a new committee for me, public safety. So I'll be diving more into the laws that we have around this. One of my concerns would be that we may already have the laws in place. And so it's a matter of enforcement and ensuring that the department has the resources to proactively stem the flow and break up the trade that's coming into the state regarding consumer fireworks that are obviously illegal.
And you have reached out to the new director of the law enforcement department. You know, I mean, they did an incredible job cracking down and seizing a number of shipments before they could be sold on the black market. But obviously, they just keep coming.
Yes. And so, you know, we're expecting a report from the Department of Law Enforcement. And that was one of the things that I was talking with him about yesterday as everyone was trying to deal with the immediate demands and immediate needs of the tragedy that happened. I think in the coming days, weeks, and months as we go through the legislative process, I think we need to drill down more on what has been the progress that the task force has gotten through and see in what ways we can better collaborate with all of the enforcement agencies that can be a part of this. You know, I think it was interesting to me to see in some of the news coverage today that the federal agencies stand ready to help us. And I think we need to call on them if we really want to break this illicit trade up. Because as you could see, every New Year's, we see the displays that are happening in every community. And we need the help to stop these products, these dangerous illegal products from coming in to our marketplace. And so any help that we can get from all levels of law enforcement, federal, state, and county, I think is going to be serious.
And, you know, the governor's thought that, you know, we make this possession of Class C felony with stiffer fines and jail terms. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
So I'm trying to drill down into what the rules are. You know, we have a specific section dealing with fireworks, but there's also things with exploded devices and bombs. And so there may be, again, sufficient laws on the books. It's a matter now of enforcement. Certainly, if there are those loopholes, as the governor identified, I think there are going to be folks open to conversations about it. But I would also say that criminalizing those folks who just possess it is not really stopping the problem. And we can't fill up our jail cells with the people. Again, if you look on New Year's Eve at the numbers of individuals and communities where this has become the norm, we need to change that norm.
Well, you know, I recall, gosh, decades ago when Governor Ben Cayetano happened to be driving back, you know, to Washington Place. And I remember the headline that next morning where he said, it's utter madness. lawmakers on the state and city level have tried to really get their arms around this and get control over it, but this is just was just tragic.
It is tragic. It's terrible. And I hope it doesn't take more tragedies for us to do something. And so I'm hoping to work with my colleagues. And there seems to be a lot of sentiment. There are folks who are talking about making sure that, again, the Department of Law Enforcement has the resources necessary to prosecute. They need to catch and then prosecute to succession, you know, and that's handing that off to the prosecutors or the state attorney generals, whoever can successfully prosecute these matters.
All right. Well, Representative Bilotti, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Catherine. And here's hoping that we can do something in 2025.
That was State Representative Della Albalotti talking to us about possible legislation that could be passed this session following the tragic fireworks deaths over the New Year's holiday. We do plan to have more coverage on this issue in the days and weeks to come. As we head into a new year, some things remain the same, and that is true when it comes to the most popular cars for Hawaii residents. But there could be some changes coming later this year involving those very same vehicles. HBR's Bill Dorman is here with more on that, including something that's never happened before. That's intriguing.
It's
good morning.
True. It's true. Aloha, Catherine. You know, Japanese cars are the most popular in Hawaii. First, the things that aren't changing has been the case for years. And brand names, biggest name is Toyota. The Hawaii Automobile Dealers Association says out of the top 10 best-selling vehicles in the state, five are Toyotas, three are Hondas, one's a Subaru. Tesla is the one that gets in the top 10 other than Japanese cars. But Toyota, here's what's dramatically new. Toyota has just come out to say it's giving $1 million to the inauguration of Donald Trump. First time Toyota's done that, first time a Japanese automaker's done that. U.S. automakers, this is sort of old hat, not a new concept. Both Ford and GM are giving $1 million apiece for the Trump inauguration, but the first time for Toyota.
Yeah, I mean, so it's unusual then. What's up with that?
It is. So inauguration, you know, there's for companies and corporate America of piling out money, writing big checks. This is not unusual. This has been happening for a very long time. Financial disclosure documents. President Biden raised nearly $62 million. Pfizer, AT&T, Boeing, all kinds of wealthy individuals as well. Trump at his first inauguration, more than $106 million. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, financial companies, wealthy individuals. Interestingly enough, Howard Lutnick, Cantor Fitzgerald, he gave $1 million last time for the inauguration. Now he's nominee for Commerce Secretary. Hmm. So political influence, donations for inaugurations.
Well, do we know what spurred Toyota to make this donation?
Well, Toyota, it's not as if a company says, well, and we'd like help with the tariffs, Mr. President-elect, but this is where we get into the politics of this, directly related to the pre-inauguration rhetoric about tariffs, which basically attacks on imports. And one of the key questions as we head into the new administration, how are these going to come out? How are they going to target them? What form are the tariffs going to be? And the way that cars and trucks are assembled or put together now, it's so global. Components come from various places. They're assembled in another place. How is that going to be worked out in the tariff deal? And so Toyota, very much concerned about that.
Yeah, and I know that Toyota hasn't done so much with EVs aside from the hybrids, but I understand you also have some information about a highly popular vehicle here at the Toyota truck.
This is crazy. I mean, the Toyota Tacoma might be somewhat common knowledge among car fans, but it's topped the list for the most popular vehicle in Hawaii for more than 20 years. What's interesting in the political discussion is the Toyota Tacoma is assembled in Mexico, but it uses parts that are made elsewhere in Mexico, parts also made in the United States, parts also made in Japan. One consumer who bought a Tacoma back in September shared the windshield sticker, you know, that goes on that shows sourcing. U.S. and Canada, 25% parts from there. Japan, 40% of the parts. Mexico, 20% of the parts. And the final assembly part point is in Mexico. So again, when you, and then when it comes to engine parts and transmission, again, USA, Japan. And so this is one of the mysteries about how this is going to play out. The Tacoma is assembled in Mexico, so it's right in the middle of this question of how do you tax these? How do you put the tariffs on? Is it going to be higher coming from Mexico than coming from elsewhere in the United States? Does it matter that things come from the U.S. And Canada? And so that's part of what Toyota, oh, okay, happy inauguration, here's $1 million.
Yeah, well, what about Toyota's plants in the U.S.? How does that all work?
That is, so Toyota now has 14 assembly plants in the U.S. Honda has a dozen plants, and Toyota says its plants now make about half of the vehicles the companies sell in the United States. But then again, some of the parts come from elsewhere. So if you're making a political speech about how Made in America is so huge, well, the people working at those Toyota plants in the U.S., those are voters, presumably. So you don't want to disrupt that. But then how do you narrow this down? It's, I mean, tax policy general, that's a trick. But certainly with these tariffs, that's all part of what is a pretty complicated picture.
Yeah, so they're kind of hedging their bets.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Yeah, and then the whole EV thing. Like, you know, I mean, I've just been watching because I've been waiting to see, you know, what other makes and models they come out with. And Toyota's been just sat on the back
so
porch.
Hybrid is where hybrid vehicles are where Toyota really leaned into, as opposed to the all-electric and the plug-ins. And again, that's evolving. But then the electric vehicle question is a whole nother set of questions that go with that. The tax, the benefits that have been in place, the incentives, the assumption is that those are going away, so up to $7,500 on the federal side. But there are other incentives. How fast and how hard are those going to go away? What's the impact going to be in terms of the sales? And a lot of the Japanese automakers are, again, trying to keep hybrids in that there as part of that, but also not leaning too heavily into full production. Then you have the Chinese, who are just outpacing everybody in the production of electric vehicles. Not sold yet in the U.S. market, but that's another question in terms of how this is all coming together. So even when you hear something on a campaign promise or a rhetoric, piece of rhetoric that, oh, this is going to be this way, The cliche about the devil being in the details, very much the case with tariffs on a number of items, but even with cars and trucks and things that are very popular here in Hawaii.
Right. So we're going to have to pay more for a Toyota Tacoma truck?
That's one of the leading questions. We'll see how these tariffs play out, but that's definitely going to be a factor in answering that question.
Yeah. Well, full disclosure, we owned a Toyota Tacoma truck, and I have been a big fan of Toyota. So, yeah, it's
full disclosure. I got a Honda in the garage upstairs.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Bill.
You bet.
We've been hearing from HBR's news director, Bill Dorman. He's been taking a closer look at the auto industry and Hawaii's favorites.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
On this week's Wait, Wait, legendary Pittsburgh Steelers coach Bill Cowher explains why he regrets going to his 20th high school reunion in Pittsburgh.
My wife was getting madder and madder as the night's going on, and then the guys were getting drunker and drunker and telling me all the things I did wrong in the San Diego Chargers.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you want people to lecture you on how you play our game, you should listen to this week's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Nayrit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna with supportive housing, such as the Institute for Human Services, NayritHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhavai.
Today's backyard quiz is about the origin story of a starchy treat. Robert Taira was born to Japanese immigrants on the Big Island. After graduating at the top of his baking class, he opened Robert's Bakery, which just so happened to be located across the street from the biggest bakery in town. Taira helped his little store stand sell out by selling soft sweet rolls inspired by Portuguese pão doce. He moved to Honolulu in 1963 and opened another bakery on King Street, which he named King's Bakery. The concept took off, and Taira built a business empire out of King's Hawaiian Sweetbread. While the business is still going strong today, the Taira family has been branching out into other endeavors. Last year, Robert's granddaughter opened a restaurant in Gainesville, Georgia, with a name referencing the location of Robert Taira's first bakery. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of this Georgia restaurant? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 and sing us the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NareitHawaii.com.
This year marks the 75th anniversary of the Narcissus Festival, and kicking off the months-long celebration of all things Chinese is the Narcissus Pageant. The event is being held this weekend at the Hawaii Theater. We recently talked to Michelle Choi, who is the event organizer, about the upcoming festivities.
Coming up is our Narcissus Pageant this Saturday, and through the years, the pageant has been very different. It's not like a regular pageant. But we kind of keep it cultural by having in the speech phase where they have learned about the Chinese culture in class, culture history from Douglas Chong. And so through a blind draw, they pick a question and then they have to research it. And then they give their speech on pageant night. And of course, with the Narcissus Festival, the girls wear the beautiful, it's called Chong Sams or Chi Pao, the Chinese evening gown. And they express themselves in different ways on how they design it. I mean, everybody sees how gorgeous it is. And then, of course, we have an opening number. But we keep it kind of at a Chinese level. But to add to this, a month later is the coronation ball. And what we want to do with that one is we want to bring back as many Narcissus Queen and alumnus back and the past president since it's 75 years.
Oh, that sounds so terrific. And where will that coronation ball be?
That'll be at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Coral Ballroom starting at 5 o'clock. And because it's called the Coronation Ball, and long ago, they've had a pre-pandemic. It was a ball where they had ballroom dancing, you know, lots of dancing. And we're bringing that back. But, you know, we have to change and keep up with the times. So what I did is we're having line dancing, you know, dance for the young ones, not just for the old ones. But they have ballroom dancing too, cha-cha, rumba, whatever. But we're also putting in line dancing. But I even had classes for that you can learn in January so you can prepare yourself for the ball. So I find that exciting because, you know, we're bringing that back, making it fun for the young ones. It's not just an old thing. It's a VIP event, but black tie optional. And so it's a chance for people to dress up, get out there and dress up and just feel good about themselves and see a good show. And then, but in this coronation ball, what a lot of people don't know is a procession. It's a procession where I feature 12 girls in Chinese minority costumes. So someone, you could say like a fashion show. And so they walk the ramp and they have these beautiful costumes. Then I have these kids carrying lanterns, Chinese lanterns, dressed in Han Fu dynasty costumes. And following them are the Narcissus participants. And then I have the the Narcissus Queen and Court and Princess, Queen and Court walking down this ramp onto this main stage where one of the Hawaii VIP dignitaries will officially crown the Narcissus Queen. It's a ceremonial thing that we have in the program.
It sounds like a real spectacle.
It certainly is. Nobody has seen that. And I tell people, it's described like crowning the Queen of England or the last emperor, you know, that kind of procession to make it exciting and then seeing that new queen being crowned. So it's a big affair. Yeah.
Yeah. So the pageant itself, now that's going to be at the Hawaii Theater Center.
Hawaii Theater, yes. And we have 9 contestants here, but, you know, we feature talent. And that's a good thing because there's four phases, but the judge's interview was earlier where we have the talent, the evening gown and the speech phase. And the girls are very talented. The process of running in a pageant, which I instituted, I think over 35 years ago, I proposed it to then President Wendell Pang. And I was able to find these awesome instructors through the years. As you know, Douglas Chong with the history, paper cutting, Chinese knotting, where they make it into a necklace and the girls. So therefore the creative part comes out and the necklace is worn at the public appearances and everything is crash course. So they even learn about acupuncture and herbal medicine. So in the future down the line, they have some knowledge of it in case they ever want to use it. And we had traditional Chinese cooking and I've changed through the years again. Mahjong came into play for the past 2 years because everyone is interested in Mahjong. We have martial arts, but then it's classes on how to defend yourself and also lion dance classes. The lion dance, now you understand about the lion, the symbolism of it, and how to even the movements of how to do it. And then you have an appreciation because being under that lion and holding it for about several minutes is very tiring. And like I said, the paper cutting, it was like when you were young, you learned about Chinese snowflakes. However, they're learning how to make Chinese characters through it. So with this festival, we also have 5 cultural classes that we gave to the public and 2 are done, but 3 are left. So people from the public could go to the sign up for cultural classes in paper cutting, but this time not a necklace, but you're going to make a keychain using that knot and also paper cutting where you can make note cards, which is what the girls do. But these are classes that instructors have taught the girls. So now people get to see what the girls go through for this cultural classes. And then also Douglas Chong is going to be giving a class on Qingming significance. And this one is really important for those who want to know about Qingming. And that's the one during April, the month of April, the Chinese go up to the grave and they pay respect to the ancestors by, you know, placing food on the grave and bowing. But people don't know why they do this. I got him for selfish reasons because I wanted to know because I've been doing that my whole life. So this is something, if you never knew about Qingming, you should come to that one too. You sign up for the classes.
I remember going up to the Manoa Cemetery, the Chinese cemetery during that time. And yeah, it's so rich in history. And so correct. The pageant really kicks off, gosh, months of, you know, wonderful events. I mean, January, I know, marks the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fire. You know, you have Chinese New Year. Yeah, so it's really a way to bring, you know, more people down to Chinatown to appreciate what we have there.
Right. And, you know, we have such a diversity of mixed cultures in Hawaii that it's really nice to see people of all different ethnicities coming out to celebrate Chinese New Year's on January 24th and 25th. But Catherine, if I could also mention, what I also included this year was working with the Honolulu Museum of Art, where they have the Family Sunday. And so this is how we share our culture with the public. It's admission is free, open to the public, but we'll have keiki crafts, you know, for the kids. We have a storyteller doing a Chinese story about the seven Chinese sisters. And we'll have stage entertainment, lion dancing, Chinese dancing. And you can also learn about the lions afterwards. And I think I mentioned martial arts. And we'll have calligraphers doing couplets for wishing people the best for Chinese New Year. And what we haven't had in a long time is the Narcissus flower carving display, where there's a group of people that carve the Narcissus flowers that looks like a bonsai plant. And that'll be on display. About 15 plants will be on display. And that's the narcissus flower that's just so fragrant, just as fragrant as the picaki. So we have a lot of culture we'll be sharing that day on February 16th. So we hope people, the public, can come out to see this display and demonstrations, even acupuncture also.
Well, we're grateful that the Chinese Chamber of Commerce is, you know, organizing, you know, all these events. So lots to mark on our calendar.
Definitely. And again, we invite everyone to come out to, all these are open to the public, although some have fees, but it is open to the public.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing this.
No problem. Appreciate you. Thank you, Catherine.
And that was Michelle Choi talking to us about the many events planned for the 75th anniversary of the Narcissus Festival and pageant. There will be a fashion show featuring clothing designer Ann Namba. The show will also include four top floral designers from San Francisco. We'll have links to the schedule of events on our website later today. Ernest Gant lived a remarkable life as a rum runner, tiki bar owner, and creator of Waikiki's International Marketplace, even though many know him by another name, Don the Beachcomber. He first visited Hawaii during Prohibition and drew from Polynesian and Caribbean cultures in creating the first tiki bar, which featured strong rum cocktails like the Zombie and Navy Grog. Later in life, he settled in Waikiki and employed hula dancers for his commercial luaus. A new documentary film delves into Don Beach's complicated life and legacy. It's titled The Dawn of Tiki, the incredulous story of Don the Beachcomber. It's been making the festival rounds for the last year. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to two of the film's directors and producers, Maxwell and Alex Lim.
How did you get involved in the film? How did you get interested in tiki culture and want to unpack the story of Don the Beachcomber?
Well, during COVID, Alex had the idea, I think, to do a short piece on one of the local LA tiki bars. We've worked together for a long time. We went to film school together. And so we started looking into doing a short piece on a tiki bar. And the more we learned about Don Beach, after somebody said, you know, none of this would have happened without Don the Beachcomber, we thought, okay, well, let's dig into that a little bit. And the more we learned about his life, which was pretty remarkable, we thought there's maybe a bigger, rather than a 10-minute film, it became a feature.
So many people know about Don the Beachcomber, kind of, but nobody really knew the true story. And we thought, if only half of these stories are true, this would be an amazing documentary.
I mean, that exactly gets to what the film grapples with, which to me is such an interesting narrative question of how do you tell someone's life story when they themselves have invented so much of it? So how did you think about, you know, how are we going to tell the truest story possible while also in instances where fiction might be inseparable or more interesting than fact? Give that some airtime, too.
This is one of the central things of the film that we really leaned into, was kind of establishing Don as an unreliable narrator of sorts, right? A lot of the story is Don kind of telling his own tales. And we wanted to keep that kind of air of mystery about him. Like, you never know for sure if what he's telling you is true. You know, we did a fair amount of research for the film, and we were able to confirm a lot of these things, right? You know, you kind of go back into newspapers and articles and documents. We sort of broke it down into things that we knew were true, things that we thought were true based on the best available information, and then things where we didn't really have any way to confirm what was being said, but we kind of let Don go for it. And that's part of the fun of the film, I think.
And I think we knew early on, if we could kind of explain that Don is an unreliable narrator, that it gave us a little bit of a get out of jail free card, that we could kind of let Don tell his own story. And as long as the true spirit of Don was there and the true essence of his character, we were doing our best to tell his story the best we could with his cooperation from the information we had. That was kind of our goal.
And you allude to him telling these stories in his own words. And the way that the documentary presents that is just such an interesting narrative choice. Could you describe, because this is an audio medium, what the animation looked like in the film and how you really brought Don's quotes to life for the viewer?
Yeah, well, you know, we knew that we were going to have to rely on animation because there are so many things we didn't have access to in terms of Don's stories. He's telling stories about Marlene Dietrich in the 1930s, and he's rum running, and he's, you know, moving to Hawaii in the 40s and 50s. And we had this interview of Don that he did late in his life, a couple of years before he died. And it was kind of like this last interview he did where he sort of recounts his entire life. And we knew we wanted to show that in some way, because once you heard his voice, we knew he was such a great storyteller. We wanted to see him. We wanted to see his emotions and see his gestures. We decided to go with stop motion animation and set it up like we had done an interview with the real Don Beachcomber. And throughout the entire movie, you've got the stop motion interview, and that kind of grounds you in reality. Like, this is really Don talking. This is kind of the mind's eye. This is Don's mind's eye of what happened. And this is his story. And we don't know if this is true or not, but the interview is really him talking. And that was kind of the idea of that.
Yeah. And just like visually, the way that you set up Don in those stop motion scenes, sitting in a chair, you know, drinking a tiki drink, smoking a cigar, being presented as if he is one of the interview subjects, kind of framed in the same way.
Totally. Yeah, we came up with that actually while we were flying to Hawaii to do some interviews, because we had already shot a bunch of interviews with a lot of people who owned tiki bars. And we were like, well, if we interviewed Don, he would be sitting in his tiki bar. How do we do that? And Max knows a lot of stop motion animators, and we reached out to them and they were excited about it. And we figured out a way to make it happen.
We had this audio early on from the interview he'd given, but it was just on a cassette tape recorded in 1986. And there's kind of a trope in documentaries where you show like a dark room and a tape slowly spinning, you know, for that old audio. But listening to Don tell his stories, he's so dynamic and so he has so much charisma. We felt like we really needed to see him.
I did want to kind of hone in on the Hawaii aspect. And one of the things I was really surprised by when you do these interviews with, you know, DeSoto from the Bishop Museum or some of Don Beach's dancers from when he built up that luau in International Marketplace, I was expecting them to have much more like mixed feelings. They were almost like uniformly positive, at least in terms of Don's intentions. And I'm wondering, is that truly how they felt?
It was, for the most part. It was something that we were surprised to kind of learn ourselves, because we weren't trying to paint him as a saint or a hero in any way. That kind of just happened because they're telling us from a historical point what his significance was with Hawaii sort of maintaining its own identity. And it's ironic because it's also Don maintaining his identity from his ex-wife who's kind of stolen his business and everything. And in doing so, he sort of helps Hawaii save a little bit of their identity when it was very difficult becoming a state. You know, language was being outlawed, celebrations of the monarchical heroes was being outlawed, and he was able to bring all that back and put a business aspect to it so that the people governing Hawaii were like, okay, well, I guess we'll let you do that. But in turn, it kind of helped perpetuate Hawaiian language and a lot of Hawaiian history that was in danger of being lost. And we didn't really know that going in until we started interviewing these people.
But you also did make the choice to talk about the commodification of tiki culture, even if Don didn't intend, you know, for the commercial luau to become what it's known as today. So why was that important for you to tell that story in this documentary?
When we were making this film, there were a lot of articles coming out about tiki in general. And, you know, tiki kind of becomes this umbrella term that everyone seems to understand what it is, but it means different things to different people. And if you look at what Don did compared to what Party City Tiki is, they're two completely opposite things. And for him to get lumped in with that, we kind of wanted to do our best to explain the separation and explain why what he was doing was different. He was focused on authenticity and he was focused on giving people a voice. When people talk about Tiki, they don't really talk about any of that. It's more talked about like, well, this is a misunderstanding by some white people in California who didn't really understand Polynesian culture. And that is true for a lot of people. We just kind of wanted to explain, hey, this is where it all came from. It came from this guy, and his intentions were good, but his idea was kind of taken and run with by the wrong people for commercialization, and it turned into something else. And that's kind of our thesis, I would say. Would you agree, Max?
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in the tiki world about cultural appropriation. And, you know, I mean, you can't argue with the fact that Don made a lot of money over the course of his life in his restaurants and bars. And a lot of that was pulling from Polynesian culture and Hawaiian culture. But like Alex said, there was, I think, maybe a deeper understanding of the people involved and dedication to authenticity and really encouraging native voices and accuracy in terms of the song and dance and some of that stuff. So I, you know, it's complicated and nuanced, and it's one of those things that you could talk for hours about, but we just wanted to at least get into it in the film and in some way to kind of help educate people who may not understand some of those points.
And then I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't mention what I think is the last shot of his gravesite in Punch Bowl Cemetery with a little sprig of mint, which, is that real?
Well, we had brought the mint as kind of a bouquet for Don, and we hope after people see this movie that it kind of catches on and becomes a thing where people bring mint to Don's site. But yeah, he was buried at the Punch Bowl Cemetery. He had the full military salute. There was the story that we didn't really go into in the film, but he told his friend, you know, when I die, this is what I want for my funeral. If there's any issues, call this number. And he wanted like the fighter jets flying over and stuff because he was in the Air Corps. And they were like, well, Don Beach wasn't, you know, they had a little bit of pushback when they were trying to get that. So his friend calls this number and it ends up being General Doolittle. And General Doolittle's like, oh, this is for Don Beach's funeral. And he made it all happen. And he had the full thing at his funeral there in the Punch Bowl Cemetery. It's really cool.
Just another of those like kind of insane, like larger than life stories.
Yeah, exactly. He ended with a larger than life story, even after death.
Oh, that was Max Wells and Alex Lamb talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Their new film is titled The Dawn of Tiki, and they say they're looking to hold screenings of it on Oahu in the near future. We'll have links to find out more about the film on the conversation page of our website after the show. Time to pull the answer to today's backyard quiz out of the oven. Earlier, we told you about the creation of King's Hawaiian Rolls, once a simple bakery on the island of Hawaii. Started by Robert Tyra, the business took off in Honolulu and spread to the continent. In 1977, he opened a 24,000 square foot bakery in California, and the rest is history. It's estimated Tyra built a $2 billion fortune out of the rolls that we know and love, and the company expanded to the East Coast in 2010 with a third bakery facility in Georgia. It's there that we asked you about the newest food project from the members of the Tyra family. It's a restaurant in Gainesville that references Robert Tyra's childhood. The answer we were looking for is Hello Hilo. According to the restaurant's website, the owners are proud to continue the Taira family's mission of spreading aloha through Hawaii-inspired cuisine and hospitality. And congrats to our winner, Karen from Honolulu. Got it right. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
HPR Generation Listen invites you to Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. It's an opportunity to connect with fellow public radio nerds in an evening of lively but friendly competition. Gen Listen connects younger listeners and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Connect with us in person at HPR Gen Listen Trivia. Sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for HPR comes from Anthology Finn Partners, helping Hawaii businesses with integrated solutions, including research, public relations, advertising, and digital marketing. AnthologyGroup.com.
When it comes to our beloved green sea turtles, beachgoers should know the cardinal rule: don't touch the honu. Still, over 100 sea turtles are found injured or dead near Hawaii shorelines each year. Skyler Dentlinger studied turtle strandings as an undergraduate at the University of Hawaii at Hilo. She recently spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about new research that looks at 40 years of turtle stranding data on the island of Hawaii.
I grew up in South Dakota, so I didn't really, prior to going to UH Hilo, didn't have a lot of turtle experience. But once I got there, I was really able to kind of immerse myself into it. Through UH Hilo, I was able to take a turtle class, which really exposed me to looking at the turtles around the island, as well as kind of looking at the tumors on the island, which kind of really intrigued me and really pushed me to, when it came to what do I want to do my senior thesis project on, to kind of focus, okay, I want to work on turtles. And then having this data set available, it really allowed me to, okay, yeah, I can do a closer look at turtle strandings. This paper was based off of my senior thesis project that I completed while at UH Hilo. Turtle strandings had been looked at for all of the other main Hawaiian islands during a 2008 study. However, they didn't really take a closer look at Hawaii Island during that study. There just wasn't enough data at that time for them to really get a good look at it. And so there was a definite need to look at Hawaii Island strandings. The island is very large. It's the southernmost in the archipelago, the lowest population density. And it also has a lot of important turtle nesting and foraging areas on the island. And so along with that need, there was also the data readily available. And so that was really important and easy to kind of go a little bit further and dig into this. So the different stranding programs on the island had all been collecting incredible data that allowed for me and my co-authors to really get a comprehensive analysis for all of the strandings on Hawaii Island. So it really allowed us to kind of answer the question of what are the strandings on Hawaii Island.
And so you looked at about 750 turtle strandings over the course of 40 years. What different categories might they fall into?
Yeah, so with the categories for those 754 turtles, we kind of separated them into the east side and the west side just because they are so different. We really wanted to look at how those strandings varied on each side. We also just looked at their main cause of stranding. We could also look at the presence or absence of fibropapillomatosis, or FP, which is just the tumors, which was a very important thing to look at, as those tumors affect a lot of turtles around the world. So that was really interesting to look at as well. And then we also looked at their size as well as their sex whenever it was possible.
Why is it important to get a handle on turtle strandings? Like, if we know, for instance, the trends over time or what causes the majority of them, how can that then inform efforts to save them?
So that's a great question. So kind of just looking at these strandings, you can look a lot about just the overall health and their conservation status. And then we can really, like, if we were to narrow down a specific cause that was really affecting these turtles, then we could potentially focus conservation efforts more on that specific cause. And that would give us just a better idea of what we need to focus on.
And so one of the interesting things time-wise that you found was that at least the reported number of turtle strandings seems to peak more recently. I think you say 2011 and 2018. What did the data show there? And then what's your team's interpretation?
So we did find two peaks. The first of was in 2011. And that has a pretty simple explanation. There was a very large earthquake in Japan in 2011 that caused a tsunami and large waves to hit the west side of the island, which caused a lot of marine life to become displaced. And then the second peak that we saw was in 2018. And then it kind of declined after that. And we don't necessarily believe that the strandings lowered after 2018. It might have just been because of COVID-19. There were less people on the beaches. There were less people visiting the island. And stranding programs rely so heavily on the public being able to report those strandings that we do think that the drop off kind of after 2018 is basically just because of those changes that happened with COVID-19.
But then I guess the finding becomes that we're likely living in an age with more turtle strandings than ever before.
The kind of increase in turtle strandings that we've seen over time is not necessarily a bad thing. It could just be because the populations are increasing. So as the turtle populations increase, there is just going to be a subsequent increase in turtle strandings.
And I'm just reading the last line of the abstract. Our findings allow for comparison with other green turtle populations worldwide. What would that look like? And why is that sort of comparison important?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely important to look at how those populations vary around the world. Especially with fibropapillomatosis, FP. That's something, again, as I mentioned, that affects all kinds of turtles around the world. We didn't find it that prevalent in our study, but different populations, for example, in Florida, have found it increasing, and they have found it all over the place. So that's kind of interesting to look at and maybe can help us determine what factors are going into that and what elements of the environment are making FP worse in different situations. We can also just kind of look at how those causes are changing around the world. Are turtles all around the world being affected by hook and line fishing gear, or is it different ways? Because if it's hook and line fishing gear all around the world, then that's a definite problem that for sure needs a solution to kind of be implemented all around. So it's definitely really important to compare the different populations around the world.
Are there any other findings that you wanted to highlight?
I think kind of just the good news that FP isn't as prevalent on Hawaii Island as it is in other populations. That is for sure a good thing that can be brought from our study, is that we weren't finding that very often, especially on the west side of Hawaii Island. It was virtually non-existent there. And so that's always a little bit of good news. You know, you're finding a lot of these stranded turtles and a lot of potentially bad news with them, but to see, okay, we are still not having too much FP around Hawaii Island is definitely good news.
That was Skylar Detlinger talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about her work on sea turtle stranding, which is in the current issue of the journal Zoological Studies. We'll have a link on our website after the show. Thank you.
Well, we're out of all time. That's it for us today. But tomorrow, we'll be keeping an eye on the political scene in South Korea as two impeachment votes in 2 weeks are an unsettling way to start the new year. Give us some feedback. Call our TalkBack line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the Conversation podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.